morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order February 15th. Today we have a public hearing, invited testimony only, and then later on this evening we'll continue with public hearing and possible work session starting at 5:30. But this morning we will just get going. We have some notables here to lead us off. And with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1532A. And Jan, could you give us a brief description of the bill, please?
I will, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a measure that raises the base minimum wage to $13.50 per hour by July 1 of 2022. It establishes a higher minimum of $14.75 by 2022 for the employees that work within the urban growth boundary of the Portland area. And for those working in non-urban counties, it establishes a lower minimum wage of $12.50, and adjusts the base minimum wage annually for inflation starting July 1 of 2023. And it sets for the Portland area a wage to be no less than $1.25 more than that base minimum wage. And for the non-urban areas, it sets it to be no less than $1 less than the base minimum. And there is an emergency clause on the measure.
Thank you, and I probably overlooked inviting a new vice chair for the week. Welcome, Representative Buckley.
Thank you very much.
So with that, I think our first speaker will be the governor, Kate Brown. Good morning. Thank you for being here with us this Monday morning, President's Day.
Good morning. Am I on?
You are.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Kate Brown, Oregon's governor. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today on behalf of Senate Bill 1532. Happy President's Day, and I hope you guys all had a great Valentine's Day and celebrated Oregon's birthday in style. I'm here to testify in support of this legislation because last year there were more than 94,000 single-parent households in Oregon headed by women with children under the age of 18. And the median family income for these families was just over $22,000 a year. That's about $1,800 a month. I think it's tough for a single person to live on that, much less while raising a child. This might explain in part why there were 20,000 homeless children in Oregon's K-12 system last year. 20,000 children. We are clearly in the middle of a housing crisis, and while raising the minimum wage alone will not fix that, nor end poverty in Oregon, it is an important piece of the puzzle. Rent and the cost of essentials like food and childcare are rising so fast, wages are not keeping up. The average cost of an infant in childcare in Oregon is roughly $11,000 a year. We have to tackle these issues now, and now is the time to act. I understand raising the minimum wage will have an impact on our small businesses. These costs are real. But I think we need to weigh those against the long-term societal costs of a generation raised in poverty. About a week ago, reported in the Salem Statesman Journal, 58% of the children living in Salem are living in poverty. These families cost Oregon business and taxpayers. That's why I began the conversation with stakeholders last fall with the goal of bringing a minimum wage proposal to the legislature this February session. I am fully supportive of the Senate amendments to my proposal, which meet the following criteria. Number one, they take into account the economic reality in Oregon that some areas are growing faster than others. It also gives businesses the time and certainty to prepare to implement a new minimum wage. And although the increase is phased in gradually, the increase starts right away, giving hardworking Oregonians a much needed boost. Finally, it offers a middle ground between nothing and two problematic ballot measures that expedite increases with absolutely no accommodation for regional economic differences. Thank you for your collective efforts to address the well-being of Oregon's working families through this important legislation. I deeply appreciate that we've been able to work together toward this important step towards economic equity. I urge your support of Senate Bill 1532 and look forward to a day in the near future that I can sign it into law. Thank you, and I am happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Governor. I know you have a busy schedule. Are there specific questions for the governor? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Governor, for your introduction. On the child care, one of the things that you mentioned was rent, food, and child care are going up at a quick rate. And this minimum wage, the numbers I have would raise child care from $18.33 a month to $15.38. I mean, wouldn't child care be raised right along with everything else, including the wages of these people that are working?
I think our goal with this proposal is to move as many families out of poverty as possible, and by raising the minimum wage, we can do that.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Governor, thank you for being here, and appreciate you coming in and actually testifying with us on this. Just wonder if you get a chance, we actually have some information from Legislative Revenues Office on just what the minimum wage will do, and it's a graph, and I'm hoping we have it up on OLIS or get a chance to look at it. But just looking at it, it looks like the biggest bang to help single families out, mothers and everything, 10-10 would be the wage that we would need. When you get into 12-10, 13-10, it's actually minus $30 a month, and that's not taken into the account of the growth of food. And I don't know if you have a chance to get your staff in your office to look at that, to consider some amendments for this when we get ready to work it this afternoon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I don't know that I've seen that particular chart, but I can provide you with statistics. I shared with you the fact that we have 90,000 households in this state headed by women with one or more children earning $22,000 a year. They cannot make basic expenses for housing, food, child care. It costs the median cost of an apartment with two bedrooms in Oregon is $864. So we have a lot of families living in poverty. I believe that raising the minimum wage it's part of the puzzle to help move these families to self-sufficiency. Under your vice chair's leadership, we made incredible investments this last legislative session, investing in affordable housing and also assisting families with affordable daycare. These pieces are also pieces of the puzzle as well. Taken together, we can work to move families towards self-sufficiency.
Thank you. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Governor, for being here, and thank you for trying to struggle with the difficult problem we have in Oregon. And I certainly share your concern for children growing up in poverty. It wasn't a good experience for me either. However, one of the groups that seems to be damaged in that process are retired seniors, low income, who are on fixed incomes. There are no provisions to adjust anything for them. And we know many of them are struggling just as severely, often have health and other problems. So this is a deep concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kinnemer, I agree. I think what you have before you in this particular legislation is a policy decision, and that is whether we expect that Oregonians who are working full-time should be living in poverty. The answer for me is no. That's why I support this legislation. Obviously, there are other tools and other areas that we need to work together on to assist families across the state. I stand ready and prepared to work with you to support our seniors, to support our working families, but most importantly, to make sure that we reduce the number of children living in poverty in this state.
Thank you, Governor. I really appreciate your comments. I really appreciate also your efforts and conversations you've had leading up to this proposal. We've been at it for, since last April, and your efforts this fall and winter through the holidays, I might add, were much appreciated. And I agree, there's lots of different pieces to the puzzle. Seniors is one of them, and You know, getting our youth into the workforce is another one. There's lots of other pieces that could be addressed in the future in different bills, and I hope that we will work on some of those other pieces of the puzzle. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing me this morning.
Up next, I was going to have Senator Dimbro and Caitlin Baggett come and talk to us a little bit more about the proposal before us. Ms. Baggett, if you need your other assistant up here, that'd be fine.
She'll pass out Valentine's.
I love that sweater. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Rep Holvey, representatives. I'm Michael Dimbro. I'm the senator for District 23. That's northeast and southeast Portland and that strange, lovely city within a city of Maywood Park. And it's my pleasure to come before you and talk to you about Senate Bill 1532. And yes, it is a Senate bill. It began on the Senate side. But I don't need to tell you that the conversations around this bill and what led to this bill really reflect both chambers. You'll remember last, I don't know when it was, April. Had hearings on this issue in your committee and in my committee. We had a long joint public hearing on the subject of minimum wage, and it went long. We heard a lot of painful stories, both from workers who are having a terrible time making ends meet, despite the fact that they're working full time, despite the fact that presumably minimum wage is supposed to be an entry level wage, but they've been at or near the minimum wage for many, many years. At the same time, we also heard from business owners, particularly small business owners, who are really concerned about the impact that a rise in the minimum wage would have on them. And I know for myself, and I know for the chair, and I know from conversations with many of you, that testimony on both sides was quite impactful. And it led us, it led Chair Holvey and I to create a work group to start working on this. We knew that, you know, certainly if we weren't convinced before, we were convinced after that hearing that this was not something that was going to be able to be passed quickly and in the 2015 session. So we created a work group that turned out to be really more of a forum than a work group because everyone wanted to be part of it. Lots of you attended at least, you know, one or more of the meetings to give us an opportunity to really understand how the minimum wage worked in Oregon and what the economic literature had to say about the impacts of raising the minimum wage, how to deal with issues like the benefits cliff, how to get a better understanding of the different economies in Oregon, you know, how different regions in the state had different needs. I think most people recognize that there were some really pressing needs in the Portland metro area. To what extent are there also pressing needs around the state? So we met through the summer and well into the fall, your good committee administrator kept us on track, and we kept her from getting the sleep she probably needed. But it was very, very useful, I think. And at the end of the day, the results of that led to Senate Bill 1532. And, you know, I think it led, I think I can speak for Chair Holvey when I say that, you know, we came to very similar conclusions based on what we heard. You know, first of all, that Oregonians are hurting, and that if the minimum wage was ever designed to be an entry-level wage, and personally, I don't believe that was the case for a lot of our populations. It is now. We have people who are stuck and who really, if you believe in the value that one should be able to work full-time in this state and not be in poverty, then we needed to take action. we, you know, we heard there was a real concern about the benefits cliff, and I think Representative Widener alluded to that in the chart that he showed. We heard from DHS that there are ways to deal with the benefits cliff, particularly in those programs that the state has a lot of control over. We did some work on that with TANF last session to smooth things out. There are other things we could do to make sure that people aren't harmed, you know, ironically, by our raising their wage. There are ways to deal with that. The one question mark that was still out there was federal Medicaid programs, and I'm happy to say that, you know, the good Senator Doc Bates over on the Senate side has done a lot of work analyzing that and came to the conclusion that we have kind of hit a sweet spot with this proposal. You know, we looked at the increases in the minimum wage that are being proposed on the ballot and that are underway in different cities like Seattle and Los Angeles. We read an enormous amount, or at least we all had homework to read an enormous amount, that, you know, a number of studies that showed, although there are legitimate concerns about the impact of a rise in the minimum wage, the fact is that if you look at all the increases that have happened, we have a lot of history with this, that the, you know, the experience shows that the effects are quite small, if they exist at all. And particularly if the increases are phased in gradually. And, you know, if you were to suddenly go to $15 an hour, right, then we're kind of in uncharted territory there. And so the lesson, I think, was that small, regular increases, according to a deliberate schedule, could be done in a way that would not have a negative impact on Oregon's economy. You know, going into the work group process, colleagues, I was actually a supporter of just lifting the preemption that we have and allowing local governments to go their own way. But the more I looked at it, the more, you know, we heard from a lot of business people who felt that that would be really disruptive for them because it would be hard to for them to predict where things are going, where the next increase was going to come. And what they valued was predictability and stability, and that was a problem. But, you know, more to the point, the more we looked at it, the less it made sense to have, you know, Portland have one wage, and then, you know, you go past 143rd Avenue, and there's another wage, or you have one wage for all for Eugene and another wage for Springfield or Corvallis or Albany. And so, you know, it really makes sense to come up with something that would be a state schedule, but with sensitivity to regional differences. and then, you know, finally, I think, for Rep. Holvey, and he'll have a chance to deny everything I'm saying, but we came to the conclusion that the way to handle something like this was through the legislature. We were elected to do this. And we felt that we could come up with a good plan, but we also, I think, understood that there would have to be future work on this. But it being the legislature's creation, it's ours, and it's our responsibility. And it will be much easier for us to go back and make changes that perhaps are needed. Rep. Holvey and I both share a very profound interest in the issue of youth employment and combating youth unemployment. And this is something that we do want to continue to work on. But doing it within this bill just would have been too problematic. And so we will, I think, come back as soon as this session is over and start working on it. Because let me tell you, that is a real can of worms, and we don't want to just throw something up against the wall. We want to do it carefully and at length. Let me just say that the Senate Bill 1532, as it was introduced, had a bunch of blanks. It, you know, if you look at the original bill, you won't see any numbers, and that's because Plugging in the actual numbers required some help from the governor. As you heard from the governor, this is an issue of great importance to her. And she, you know, really to her credit, she pulled together a group of people from business and from labor. And, you know, using the bully pulpit that she has as a governor, she was able to do that. And they worked and worked and worked. And certain things became clear. Ultimately, they were able to provide us with the numbers that we were looking for. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not saying that at the end of the day, the business interests and the labor interests shook hands and said, this is it. We're going to sign on the bottom line here. No, but they provided the governor with some ranges, and she, acting almost like a mediator, I think, in this process, was able to put together a proposal. In the initial proposal that came out of that group, there were only two regions, even though, you know, the original bill had three regions. But the feeling was that two regions would be about all that we could handle in a short session. And getting to three, you're starting to get more complicated. And so that's what went into the initial amendments. And as soon as they came out, we started hearing from people, particularly in the more remote parts of the state, that, we're different. We're different here on the frontier, and, you know, we need our economy isn't as resilient as other parts. And I know that many of you heard from them. We started hearing from many of our colleagues, look, if you're going to do this, go back to the three-region system, and that's what we've done. So that's where we are today. I'd be happy to answer any questions ultimately that you have. I assume you have some questions about the methodology for creating these regions. Caitlin here, I think, is going to help to explain those and how essentially they're based on the notion of self-sufficiency. What does it take for an Oregonian to be able to provide for him or herself and their family through their work? And not have to rely on public assistance or private charity. So,
thank you.
Yes.
And maybe we could move to Caitlin real quickly, too. Right. We have about 5 minutes left in your time slot, and that doesn't count questions. So if you could kind of run through your methodology and the maps and how you came up with, helped us come up with what we thought was a good plan.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Caitlin Baggett. I'm the executive director of the North Star Civic Foundation, and it's an honor to be here again. I was here earlier this year to share general information about economic resiliency, economic health at a regional level, and cost of living. I'm going to go through slides that show three things. First are maps related to whether or not the region chosen responds to that economic data. Second will be a timeline that shows how the proposal compares to current CPI increases and the ballot measure that is also being proposed. And finally, a slide that shows to what extent this proposal in fact meets goals of increasing self-sufficiency. Approach to this work has been to focus on the right structure, not the right wage number, but these slides will relate to that. The slides are showing some broadly accepted economic data and concepts that respond to regional economies. And our foundation, believe, offers the legislature flexibility as regional economies change. The next seven slides are maps. I'm going to go through them very quickly. What they'll show you is that with the basic economic indicators that that could be used to develop this policy, that there are many different ways of looking at regions. This first is a map that shows where the county-level rental market is above average and below average. The second map shows where county-level self-sufficiency hourly wage is above average and below average. The third map shows where annual increases in cost of living have been above 6%, which is to say twice as fast as inflation, below 6%, and in three counties where it has been rising exceptionally quickly at above 13% annually. The next map shows where county-level median income is above average and below average for Oregon. And this shows where county-level employment is above average and below average for Oregon. And where the share of jobs that are offered at less than $15 an hour within each county is below average and above average in Oregon. You see that in rural areas, a greater share of jobs are low-paid jobs, which means an increase will have a more significant effect on those economies. And also where agricultural jobs are a larger share of the workforce within a county. And this shows areas where it's less than 5% of the overall workforce, areas where it's greater than 5%, and really those gray areas go up to about 15%, and then two outlier counties where agriculture makes up more than 20% of the workforce in that county. This final slide is an aggregate of all of those indicators. Each one has been given equal weight, and it gives you a sense of how all of those indicators lay on top of each other. And this is the proposal, Senate Bill 1532A. I'll go back. I'll toggle back for a second so you can see how they compare. And you have this for your record. So this map gives you an indication of how the Senate bill compares to the best economic indicators we have for how to make this kind of choice about what regions the bill should relate to. This chart shows the schedule for regional wage increases. The red line shows the proposed ballot measure, IP 58. The gray line shows current increases with CPI. And the three blue lines are Region 1, Region 2, Region 3 in the Senate bill. And finally, the chart on the left, I know that you can't see it. This is really about red, yellow, and green. Shows where we are with self-sufficiency in 2014. Red means that for that family type, whether it's a single adult on the far left-hand column all the way to a family with two full-time income earners, whether or not that family can be self-sufficient. Red is below 80% of self-sufficiency. And as you can see, we have a significant self-sufficiency issue in Oregon right now. And 77% of the families that are below self-sufficiency are in those top three rows, the most urban counties in the state. Yellow is between 80 and 95%, and the green is above 95% of self-sufficiency. The table on the right shows, with 1532A, what self-sufficiency could look like in Oregon in 2022. I know that you have this in front of you, and so you can see the words. For the column on the far left-hand side for a single adult, what that shows is that every single adult in Oregon with no dependents in the wages set forward in the three regions in 1532A should be able to reach self-sufficiency working full-time in 2022. That represents 33% of all Oregonian households that are currently below self-sufficiency, rising above self-sufficiency in that time period. You also see in the far right-hand column a greater movement towards things being in the green, above 95% of self-sufficiency, with a few counties that are hovering around 85% in the more urban areas, but a significant improvement in self-sufficiency for those areas.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And all the work you've done on this and helping Chair Dimbrough and myself come to some agreement on what this proposal looks like. So with that, any questions? Representative Evans.
Thank you. I really do appreciate all the work that's been done on this. I represent a district that has a unique characteristic. Salem is not just in one county, it's in two. And in Polk County, it's actually the population base. And what I'm trying to ask is, when you were doing the maps and doing the planning on this, there's some figures that were also presented, not in this document, but earlier, having to do with percentage of county that are minimum wage workers. Polk County is actually 8.5% minimum wage workers. And what that seems to make sense to me is that outside of West Salem and a couple other small areas, there's a lot of folks working in the sectors that would be otherwise in the rural area categories. How did you work through issues like that with your formula? How did you look at counties, not just in raw number, but in kind of the characteristics of them as you were trying to come around this?
You want to answer that? Yeah, this question of the nature of counties and basing this on counties, was certainly something that we looked at.
So when you're looking at increases in the minimum wage at a regional level, what you're looking for is resiliency. So the larger the workforce and the more diverse the set of jobs that are available in an area, the greater resiliency you'll see. So moving from a city, which in a small city could be relatively low resiliency, to a larger and larger area is preferable. Even some counties that have fewer than 10,000 people in their workforce would be a relatively small grouping to work with. And so our foundation's view on this has been that the larger the geographic area, the better, understanding that the economic data we have and that the state has relates to counties first, but also to these prevailing wage districts and local workforce areas, but that in Oregon, urban and rural areas are interdependent. Separating them out from each other doesn't make a lot of sense beyond the kind of larger groupings that have been set forward.
Okay. Representative Kinnemeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, thank you for being here. I guess the thought that struck me was you're not including youth, and I understand your rationale. On the other hand, I guess my comment would be that they are currently underemployed significantly, and the longer that goes on, the less likely it is, and it's sort of a training wage, and I think that's a serious flaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kinnemeyer, as I mentioned, this is an area for future work. Youth unemployment is not an Oregon problem. It's a national problem. In my committee, we heard a report last week about that. But every state really needs to do things to tackle it. What we do not want to do is rush to something too quick. You know, the state of New York did that. They did an increase to their minimum wage, and they, just to get it passed, I think in the final hours of the session, they instituted a tax credit that would, benefit companies that employed minimum wage workers. And unfortunately, it was kind of cobbled together very quickly. The upshot is, I believe, that subsidies are going to companies that don't need them, the sort of large chains that are employing a lot of youth, and are not going to the small businesses that really do need those subsidies. We have to, I think, be very, very careful.
Thank you. And we have a couple of panels left to do where we'll have more time for questions. Aaron, you got a question specific to the data?
Yeah, well, to Senator Zimbrowski, what he had referenced about me earlier. So just to follow up on it. Senator Zimbrowski, I appreciate all your work that you've done on this, and I know you've devoted a lot of time to it. And my concern is the single moms. I mean, my mom was single, raising me and my brother at one time and everything as well, and lived in that situation. And when I'm looking at a lot of the data coming in, he said we're going to adjust that benefits cliff. So are we going to move things up so they don't fall off the benefits cliff and give more? And will that not increase the state's budget or what we have to pay out to help people if we do increase those benefits? Because last thing I want to do is create a situation where we have more people going on the unemployment line, and then the people that are getting that slight increase in salary, now they're still receiving all the other benefits, and we have all these people coming on, and we're going to put a big burden on the state's budget that Representative Buckley is going to have to deal with, and the taxpayers can't really absorb too much more.
Thank you. Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, I very much appreciate that, and that's why we spent a lot of time thinking about this. And first of all, let me say, I'm sure I speak for everyone on your committee, that we want people to be making it through their work, right? We don't want them to have to rely on, food banks and shelters and government assistance. So, if done wrong, this benefits cliff could be real. And a lot is going to depend on the individual circumstance of the individual. What we don't want to see happen, certainly, is somebody gets a $10 raise in a week, and that puts them just above, the qualifying level, and they lose everything. And so what you want to do, and, I referenced the notion of smoothing, you want to make it so that as their wage goes up, their benefits sort of ratchet down, and until they really don't need those benefits anymore because they're earning enough. They're not subject to an arbitrary cliff. And that's the goal, and, I think from all indications, we should be able to get there.
Thank you. Really do need to move on with the rest of our panel. Thank you so much for getting us started and your work on this proposal. Up next, I'd like to have Lee Gershwill, Chris Gerard, Erica Kirsch, and Evan Remington. Maybe we could, if we don't have four chairs, maybe we can find one.
There we go. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Oh, they got their own. Thank you, Ashley, anyway. And go ahead and introduce yourself for the record before you speak. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Erica Kirch, and I am from Joy Central. Thank you to the Chair Holvey and for the rest of the committee for allowing me to be here today. Joy Central is a nonprofit daycare and preschool center in Northeast Portland, Multnomah County. And I'm here today because I want to express my concern about the way that this increase could really negatively affect our business and our greater community in Montevilla neighborhood. Our mission at Joy Central is to support our neighborhood and our young working families with high quality childcare and family education. Unfortunately, if this bill passes, this will negatively affect the direct families that we're trying to support, the young, hardworking families in our neighborhood. We are a nonprofit organization, so we operate on very slim margins. There's a direct correlation between the compensation of our staff and the tuition rates that we charge our families. The only way that we can imagine being able to keep our doors open if this bill passes is to immediately and drastically increase our child care rates to every single one of the families in our center. The cost of child care is already very high. For an infant and toddler in Multnomah County, it can be upwards of $1,400. At our center, it's about $1,100. For a preschool student, 3 years and older, it's about $850 a month. Our families are already struggling to meet that rate. They are already having a hard time, no matter what profession they're in, to devote that much money to having their kids, and that's per child. And if this were to increase, I imagine it would be at least $300 to $500 more each month immediately that we would have to increase our rates. Most of our families, there's no way that they could meet this. They would have to choose between keeping their job or staying home with their kids. DHS has just recently increased their rates for employment-related daycare, and that would not be covered under any kind of raise. They raise it for 3 years at a time, and so over that time period, we would not be able to fully support the families that are receiving this extra care. We are in Multnomah County, but our parents come from all over to commute into Portland, and they commute to be at our center. We are open extra hours to be able to meet families that work in every different type of industry. And we find that for them, they're not living extravagant lifestyles, even though they're living in Multnomah County. We're in far northeast Portland, where people are living and working very hard just to meet what they can right now for their child care. They're looking for a trustworthy center, and they can't always find that for the rates that they can afford. Our staff is the most important thing to our organization, and so we devote over 70% of our annual budget directly to the staff compensation for those that are working in the classroom every day with the children. This is a really huge amount of most businesses' budgets, but for us, on the slim margins that we work, this is where all of our money goes. We have a really strategic way of planning lead teachers in the classrooms, along with assistant teachers, aid workers, substitute teachers, and floats, so that we can meet the state required ratios of teachers to students in the classroom and be able to make sure that we have lead teachers that are doing very important jobs of planning their classrooms, managing the students, speaking with parents, lesson planning, planning activities for the students, and their communication with the parents is very important, so they are paid more. And we also have assistant teachers and float teachers and substitutes that some of them are high school students, some of them are college students. For them, this is an after-school job. This is an entry-level position to gain some experience and to give them some spending money. It's a great way for them to get into the industry and to learn about young working families, but we have a reason that we have our compensation scale different for all of these employees. If we needed to raise even our most entry-level employees up to $1,475, there would be no additional money that we could give those lead teachers. So there would be no differentiation in how much money they make for the extra responsibilities that they have. In fact, we would probably need to cut the benefits of our full-time employees, and they would have no extra benefits or compensation for all of these extra responsibilities.
Thank you. I will remind you that you have 20 minutes for your group, and as you're continuing speaking, their time is going down.
Sorry about that. So, in conclusion, then, when Joy Central first opened, I was assistant teacher there in a toddler classroom, and I worked my way up to the director position. So this organization is very important to me, and the most important thing is that we can keep our doors open and keep our rates affordable for the over 250 families in the Montevilla neighborhood that we serve each week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Evan Remington. Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. 9 years ago, I founded my company, Fresh and Local Foods. We're headquartered here in Salem, Oregon. I remember nursing my then newborn, who's sitting behind me here, and seeing a statistic that was absolutely shocking to me, which was 54% of our kids in Oregon are qualifying for free and reduced lunch. That was shocking to me, and having had a baby now and thinking about what we as a society are feeding our kids, and I really started to get passionate about that. So I started working on a business plan, put that together, raised about $500,000 through Salem resident investors, and opened my business in May of 2007. Leased a garage here on North Broadway downtown, started making cold calls to daycares, and started selling our meal program, and at that time ran back to the garage, cooked the food, packaged the food, made up an invoice, and then went and delivered the food. Now, 9 years later, we have a 14,000 square foot state-of-the-art LEED Platinum food processing facility with 25 employees here in Salem, and we've got another 3,000 square foot warehousing and distribution facility with 5 employees in Fife, Washington, and we certainly continue to grow. It's very exciting for me, and I'm very proud that today 20,000 kids a day throughout Oregon and Washington get to eat fresh, local, natural and organic, high quality food that's sourced right here in Oregon. One of the things that has been helpful, and I think one of the reasons we've been so successful growing a business in the middle of the biggest recession, certainly I hope in my lifetime, is our commitment to each other and our team, and the people that have come right alongside me to kind of weather the storm and, you know, do all of the things that you have to kind of have the tenacity to get through to be able to grow a company. We currently today don't pay any of our employees the current minimum wage. Nobody starts starts at minimum wage at my company. You know, we have the I have the philosophy that we pay as high wages as the company can afford. You know, we do not look at it as, you know, let's just get away with the bare minimum that we can pay. We pay the highest wages the company can afford. And one of the things that's been kind of interesting to me is, you know, so then, you know, maybe someone might ask, well, why? Well, what's the big deal then if you're already paying these wages that are proposed? Well, what's happening is already employees are coming to me saying, you know, I expect my 50 cent an hour wage increase over the next 6 years, just as the minimum wage increase is proposed. And that, you know, that starts to get daunting, just to try and figure out how to afford it. One of the things that I think is really unique about the food industry in particular is, Eric had talked about operating on thin margins. That is absolutely the food business. And in our industry, we work with under the National School Lunch Program, which sets the meal price to be reimbursed to our customers per meal for food that is meeting the nutritional guidelines. So we don't even set the price. The federal government sets the price of what we can pay or what we can charge for school lunch. And so now as we're trying to figure out, okay, how do we figure out this mandatory paid sick leave? You know, what is the minimum wage going to look like? What else is being talked about as far as, you know, flexible schedules? All of these things that increase our costs really start to get scary, because the only control I have over my margin is managing my costs and having certainty and understanding of those costs. I can't just pass through my price. Again, the federal government sets my wage. I am also part of a trade association, and I know from my colleagues in the industry that, I mean, we're unique in that we are selling our food products in Oregon and Washington currently, which actually is quite lucky, because a lot of my colleagues in the food processing industry, they're competing out of state and internationally. You know, if they're a blueberry grower and processor, or, you know, somebody that's growing another commodity that they're growing, packaging, selling, you know, they're not selling in Oregon. They're selling out of state and out of the country even. And so, again, it really hampers our food processing company's ability to compete if we're producing food that has higher costs than anywhere else essentially in the world. So I just would ask you to consider that. And just also remember that not all businesses are created equal. We're very proud of what we do. It's just something that I'm very proud of. We have scalability, and I want to help impact all of our children in a positive way by increasing the health of our kids in Oregon and Washington and beyond. But I'm concerned that that, you know, at some point we just won't be able to continue to grow and to do that. And also that, you know, we're always going to be a food business, which is great, and I'm proud of it, and that's a kind of a legacy to our region. But, you know, not all businesses are created equal. We're not a tech company or, you know, some other industry where we just have high margins. So perhaps if there is an opportunity to further consider other modifications, to maybe consider businesses like in the food industry and in childcare that could somehow have more consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Whoever's next, your time is dwindling quickly.
How is our time, Mr. Chair?
You have about 3 minutes apiece.
Chair Holby, Vice Chairs, I'm Chris Girard, members. I'm Chris Girard, CEO of Plaid Pantry and Chair of ANZA. In business management, to solve a problem, you have to first define it accurately. And there's a problem with the definition of the problem with this legislation. A stated goal that everyone agrees with is no one who works full-time should live in poverty. The problem is with an incorrect inference from that statement, and that is most lower-wage people who work full-time live in poverty, and that's not the case. And from this incorrect premise, we then say, therefore, raising the minimum wage will lift workers out of poverty, which is also not correct. Except for relatively few but really unfortunate special circumstances, no one working full-time is living in poverty because we have government assistance safety net programs. There's no question that everybody wants people so situated to be able to do better for themselves, and their families, but this approach that you're looking at won't accomplish that. The real problem is that these workers are trapped in lower wage jobs because of the benefits cliff. And I'm glad Representative Widener brought that up. I refer you to the LRO study that was done last year, where someone, if this bill passes, gets a raise, the people that you're trying to help will have less money. The single mom working low-wage job, their pay will go down with each step of this increase, which is a really bizarre situation. People who increase their earned income ought to keep a reasonable amount of that incremental money that they earn. That's the situation we should be addressing here, not raising a wage rate that will not get to the people that you're trying to help. And also, as Representative Widener, he and I did not talk before this, by the way, points out, it's going to cost money, but I'd look at that as an investment, because what needs to be done is to taper that benefit cliff, make it not a cliff, taper it. It's going to cost a little bit more to start, but it will pay for itself as workers increase their earned income. That subsidy will go down, but it does cost some money up front, and somebody should look at those costs. The real problem with people living in poverty is jobs and lack of full-time jobs. In my written testimony, you'll see two maps of Portland as an example, and contrary to popular misconceptions, large parts of Portland have the very poorest areas of the state with horrible unemployment. And you can see that the unemployment corresponds with the poverty. The proposed solution in this bill is a jobs killer. It's a small business killer. It won't raise people out of poverty. It'll put more in. You've seen Dr. Fruit's reports, 66,000 jobs. I understand a lot of members don't believe that, but I'd again refer you to LRO. They didn't model this one, but last year they modeled a $2 increase, and they said 20,000 jobs are going to get killed. Well, that's 10,000 jobs per dollar, and I don't think a $5 increase rolled out is going to be linear. I think it's going to be very dramatic. But if you apply that math, that's 50,000 jobs, 66,000, but who's counting? I'd like to use Platt as an example of why that many jobs are going to get killed, because it is hard to get your grasp of it. If you scooped up a sample of small businesses, they look a lot like our company. You're going to have some that make very big profits, some that are kind of in the middle, and some that are down here struggling. Our company has that kind of profile. most of the small business constituents that I'm seeing in the testimony fit into this kind of lower range. They're making a decent profit now, but using Plaid as an example of these businesses that you're hearing from, a $13.50 minimum wage we modeled adds $42,500 to the store's expenses. We have 20 stores that make less than this. We think we can save a few of them, but we're going to close 14 stores. Here's the meat of what I'd like to have explained here and where the big job hit comes. Our puniest profit store still pays $250,000 a year in wages, payments to the suppliers that service our stores, property tax, rent. And so we try to squeeze $42,000 expense on that, and you wipe out $250,000. That's what you're hearing from these small businesses. They're paying what they can, but this is too much. In our slice of stores, but also for small businesses similarly situated.
I'd like to give your final panelists at least a minute to talk, if possible.
Stretching out doesn't fix it. It just delays the agony. A company's lucky if it makes inflation in a little bit. This increases expenses 6.9%. Next year in Portland, the 50 cents in July wouldn't be much, but next year in Portland, $1.50, that's a 15% increase. There's going to be carnage in small businesses. Too far, too fast.
Thank you.
You're going to have to talk fast.
Okay.
I apologize.
All right. Chairman Holvey, Representative Kennemer and Buckley, members of the committee, I'm Lee Geshwell, and I am the current president of the Oregon Association of Nurseries.
And we were one of those groups that participated with the governor in the fall trying to bring the voice of agriculture to this particular issue. Since we're low on time, I really want to give you one example. My compatriots have talked a lot about how this will affect small businesses, commodity businesses, and the agricultural industry in general. But I really want to talk about wage compression. So in our nursery, like many other businesses in the nursery industry and in agriculture, we try to pay our low skill and our entry-level positions about 15% over minimum wage. And for those of you who may not know that, there is a huge labor shortage in the agricultural industry in Oregon. And so some of that is what we need to pay, and some of that is what we'd like to pay. We'd like to pay our people something over minimum wage so they have some pride in their work. More skilled employees typically make 50% or 1.5 times what the minimum wage is. And we try to give a good cost of living increase to all of our employees every year. So under this current proposal, I did some math, and my entry-level positions will be at the minimum wage by 2019. So they are above the minimum wage now, and they will be at minimum wage by 2019. And my skilled positions, who are now currently 50% over minimum wage, when it's fully implemented to $13.50 in 2022, their wages will erode to just 17% over minimum wage. That's what wage compression is going to do. So we're trying to do our best and give people decent paying jobs. We're carrying employees over the lean times of our year when we're slow. We're trying to keep these employees year round. We're going to have to probably lay people off to really manage our costs. And that's what's going to happen. And it's really unfortunate because Oregon agriculture and horticulture has been a shining star in this country. I think we can make a good argument for reducing our carbon footprint by producing things locally, and that's not going to happen anymore. We're going to have stuff coming in from out of state, and it's unfortunate.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Fagan.
Thank you all very much for taking the time to come down today. I know it's just not easy. I want to ask you a slightly hypothetical question, and you might even each be able to answer just quickly. Could you tell us, based on the testimony that you just gave, what the impact would be to your business if the minimum wage were to go up to $13.50 an hour starting in 2018?
I think they would still struggle in a similar way. So when I said that we would go up to $500 more a month, it would probably be more like $250 more a month for our tuition, which would still put families outside of that DHS-covered child care.
Representative Kinnamer.
Chair, just...
Oh, I'm sorry. Was that just one...
Yeah, I mean, certainly anybody could respond. And just to be clear, the $13.50 is about $2 more by 2018 than this current proposal. So it's dramatically more.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Yes, go ahead.
We actually modeled $13.50 for our company because we didn't think conceivably it would go higher than that. So that was the outside. But that's the number where we close 14 stores, we lay off 145 people, we eliminate $3.4 million in payroll, and we have 145 people out of work, and nobody's got a plan for them. They're my responsibility now. I'd like to know who's going to take care of them. It's not Plaid Pantry.
I think that would cost us, I mean, if it was today, an immediate $32,000 additional a year. Right now we're a, you know, $2.5 million business. We net about 6%. So, I mean, that's a huge, huge chunk.
Yeah. Thank you. Satisfied?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Next question was Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you. I guess I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I appreciated about daycare. It was interesting. I saw earlier the testimony from Learning Tree, which is in Washington and Clackamas counties, and very similar huge increases in child care that are going to more than negate an income change for minimum wage. The other point that I think the panel made that I think is particularly scary is about compression and how your current employees are going to have to be paid more. So this is a wage hike across the board, which has a huge inflationary impact. And 14 of small businesses going under is dramatic, and I just want to make that, reemphasize those points. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just said to comment on the benefit cliff issue. We have more recent data than the data that's in the chart that's been shown from LRO. Senator Bates has done a substantial amount of work on how the benefit cliff issue works with this proposal that's in front of us today. So I'm hoping that we can get that additional information to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And one more question, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of on the agricultural side, because I get a little concerned because I'd met with actually they're berry farmers, blueberry farmers, and they said they would probably be looking at a large reduction in migrant labor that they use and everything with this, because they'll go to mechanizing as far as picking the blueberries and stuff. And the nursery industry, do you see that happening? Because they, right now it's about 42,000 in Oregon, and they said they would probably cut that in half. And then the processing plants would move probably to Idaho, Nevada, or Washington, were the comments that I had received just because of the minimum wage. And I'm just kind of curious where the nursery industry would be on that, or what numbers you've heard.
The nursery industry has been doing a great deal of automation because of our labor shortage, and we will continue to do so. In my own business, we've done an expansion, and we have, with the expansion, we've done as much automation as possible because we really don't intend on hiring any additional people. We just cannot afford it. There's not the margins there to do it. And you're seeing crops like broccoli, which used to be grown in the Willamette Valley, are no longer being grown here. There's a reason why hazelnut production is increasing in the state of Oregon, and it's because it's a low-labor crop. Things like hop production, another star of our state, that's moving to Idaho because the wage rate is lower over there. So we're either going to automate or we're going to change our crops. And that's what's going to happen.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate you being here this morning and giving us your important perspectives on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Up next, I have Patty Whitney Wise, Laura Rondeau, Sarah Joanne Ides, probably didn't say that right, and Graham Traynor.
I'm sorry. He was in his way. He was in his way.
No, he looked right at me.
And if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Patty Whitney Wise. I'm the director for Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, and I'm here to testify in favor of the minimum wage hike. One of the things that we're concerned about are the number of families with children who struggle to put food on the table for those children, especially when they're in low-wage jobs and working long hours. Oftentimes, a single mom will have worked long and hard and come home and have to forego her own food in order to feed her children. This shouldn't happen with a full-time job. And I want to share a personal story about what happened to my family when my father died suddenly. My mom was a stay-at-home mom of four kids. I was the oldest of four. This was back in 1968 here in Salem. Luckily, she was able to get some short-term training and go back to work. While we faced some very hard times, we never went without food, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One, luckily, the cost of living in Salem is lower. Secondly, the value of the minimum wage in 1968 was about $11 an hour, and that was enough for my mom to bring home enough to feed us. And we were all in school except for my youngest brother at that point, so there were some mitigating circumstances. But I want that same thing for other families. I want those families who are struggling to raise their kids to have enough to put on the table. So there's a couple of things I would just like to address from the prior panels. One is the benefits cliff. That's a real concern. And in 2015, we addressed that cliff both for TANF and for employment-related daycare. Now, employment-related daycare would be a lot better and work better if it served more families. It only serves about 9,000 right now. So even though there's a cliff in that program, most families in minimum wage jobs are not getting that benefit. So that's a cliff they would not face. SNAP, it used to be called food stamps, also goes down as your income goes up. It's not a cliff. In the other instances, I do believe that with more families earning more money and putting more money into the tax system, there would be enough additional revenue in the state to help address some of the other cliffs. So I really feel strongly that the increase in wages will benefit people overall. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Whoever wants to be next.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Laura Rondeau, and I am here to testify in support of raising the minimum wage in Oregon. I am one of thousands of low-wage workers in Oregon that desperately need an increase in the minimum wage to survive. I'm 26 years old, who can't afford to go back to college, and I'm struggling to get by working 35 hours a week at a job that pays Oregon's minimum wage, $9.25 an hour. I work at Cafe Yum near Portland State University, and when all is said and done, I bring home about $1,100 a month, if that. That money does not last. My rent is $575 a month. I rent a room in a house with four other people. I can't afford a car, so I use public transit, which accounts for about $100 a month. So a difference in $100 a month is whether or not I can get to work reliably and pay for my transportation to and from work. I'm about four quarters away from completing my bachelor's degree at PSU. Unfortunately, I'm racking up too much debt to go back to school. My hope was to work for a while and save up money to reduce the amount that I need to borrow. However, I have not been able to get a job paying a living wage, so I'm stuck. One day, I hope to finish my undergraduate degree and complete master's and doctorate degrees to become a clinical psychologist. However, the deck is stacked against me and others of my generation. We can't make enough money to save for college, and we can't afford to go to college without some sort of savings. The legislature can take an important step this session and give thousands of Oregonians a chance. Raise the minimum wage in Oregon to a living wage and pass Senate Bill 1532. Give me an opportunity to save money and go back to college. Thank you for the opportunity to share my story.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Kenmare, and Vice Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Jonitas, and I am the Director of Social Responsibility for New Seasons Market. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of raising the minimum wage in Oregon and in support of Senate Bill 1532. New Seasons Market was founded on the idea that businesses can be a force for good, serving our staff, our communities, and our planet, all as part of growing a healthy, sustainable business. We opened our first store 16 years ago, and today we have 16 stores in Oregon, over 3,000 employees, and we are one of the state's largest private employers. Our success proves that a triple bottom line approach and values can align with building a successful and profitable business. Our company believes that our staff are our greatest asset. They are at the center of our success, and as such, we've always been committed to paying fair wages and industry-leading benefits. In fact, for more than a decade, our starting wages have been well above the state regulatory minimum. Recently, however, we've become increasingly concerned about the rising cost of living in Oregon, particularly in the Portland metro area where our stores are located. With housing costs skyrocketing, many of our staff have been telling us that they simply can't make ends meet. And as a company that's deeply committed to progressive compensation and taking care of our staff, we had to face a really tough reality that even with our best intentions, our wages were not keeping up. We believe that our staff and all Oregonians who work full-time should be able to thrive in the communities where they live and work. And that's why at New Seasons Market, we made the decision to raise our starting wages to $12 an hour on January 1st of this year. This was a very significant investment on our part. We raised our starting wages by 20%. But really, it's only a first step, and we can't do it alone. We believe it's time for Oregon's minimum wage to raise so that every Oregonian has the opportunity to prosper. New Seasons is standing with a growing number of businesses across the state that believe that an increase in Oregon's minimum wage will make a positive impact by improving quality of life, building a sustainable economy, and establishing thriving communities. You've heard this morning, and you will continue to hear from opponents that say businesses can't afford to raise wages, but our experience is that that is simply not true. Grocery certainly is a low-margin industry, but time and again, we've found that when we increase our wages, our turnover goes down, our morale goes up, and the result is a boost to our bottom line. In fact, New Seasons Market's turnover rate is significantly lower than our competitors, in large part because of our commitment to progressive compensation. We know that employee retention drives a positive customer experience, and that helps us to succeed. So I'm here today to advocate for legislation to increase the minimum wage in Oregon that follows three common sense principles. First, just as the case for raising the minimum wage is clear, so too is the need for businesses to have a level playing field. Individual employers like New Seasons cannot reasonably move towards $15 an hour on their own if we must compete against other companies whose low wages are essentially subsidized by taxpayer-funded public assistance programs. The tide must rise for all ships, which is why statewide public policy is the right path forward. Second, minimum wage policy should account for the difference between urban and rural economies. While we support a path towards 15 in the Portland market, we also understand the cost of living is very different in rural economies. As a company that partners with growers, producers, ranchers, farmers all across the state of Oregon, this issue is of the utmost importance to us. Senate Bill 1532 provides a smart solution to this disparity by creating three regions with wage increases that reflect real differences in cost of living and median income. And third, minimum wage increases should be phased in, as has happened in Seattle and San Francisco, so companies can plan and build them into their budgets. Senate Bill 1532 provides workers across the state with a much-needed increase in 2016, while offering a very reasonable phase-in period and a gradual increases so businesses can plan between 2017 and 2022. Ultimately, one local business's employee is another's customer. And when people are paid more and can afford to buy more, the positive effects ripple throughout the community. This legislative session is the right time for responsible action, and raising the minimum wage is the right thing to do for our staff, for our communities, and for all of Oregon. Thank you very much for inviting my testimony. At the end, if there's time, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today as well. My name is Graham Traynor with the Oregon AFL-CIO, the statewide federation of labor unions, and we've been leaders in the Raise the Wage campaign as well as endorsing the Fight for 15 and the 15 Now campaign. The Oregon AFL-CIO represents over 300,000 workers in Oregon and is a voice for all workers in the legislative process. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 1532A, and I want to do that by talking about two very different professions and the women that work in them that have one thing in common. Both of these industries pay low wages. There are several low-wage professions within the Portland Airport, including concession workers at all of the storefronts that travelers see and interact with to get their coffee, for example. But I'm going to focus on people at the airport that help with your luggage, clean out the cabins, fuel the planes, transport passengers through the airport. These hundreds of workers are on the front lines of safely preparing planes for passengers and ensuring people can make their flights with their luggage as comfortably as possible. These jobs are both dangerous and physically demanding. People fuel airplanes, move luggage and passengers, all in an effort that travelers can have a safe trip. The jobs are often minimum wage jobs with the average wage at $10.30 an hour, and 67% of these jobs are offered with no health insurance from their employer. Their employers are directly contracted by the airlines, and it is the airlines that determine the wages and benefits workers receive. You may have heard that it has been a record profit year for the airline industry because of low fuel costs in particular. They just reported $8.8 billion in profits, a 61% increase from the previous year. Alaska Airlines, who's the major airline at PDX, just reported the fifth straight record profit year. Their profit increased 40% in 2015. At the same time, a worker like Casil Capriel, who has worked at the airport contractor Huntley for 9 years, has not received a raise and still makes minimum wage despite the strong growth in the industry. She's a single mom of three kids, and her job does not even cover her increasing rent. There's no path for promotion or advancement in her job, and to make ends meet, she relies on government assistance, like many have talked about today, and nonprofits like ERCO to keep her lights on. She can't get by no matter how hard she tries, but for the last 5 years, Alaska Airlines has made record profits. 50% of Oregon workers who work minimum wage jobs work for companies with over 100 workers. Some of these employers are very similar to the Alaska Airlines example. They've been making record profits and leaving the workers behind. Now I want to talk about a very different industry, caregiving. Child care and home care workers, workers in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and others across the spectrum of care are union members, members of SEIU. These workers care for our moms, our dads, our grandparents, and our children. Day in, day out, they make sure that the people we value most are fed, safe, clean, comfortable, and living with dignity. Caregivers, who are overwhelmingly women, take care of our loved ones' needs most often when they can't even take care of themselves. These jobs are both physically and emotionally draining, yet they're undervalued and underpaid. Most caregivers make slightly above minimum wage. They often can't afford to pay their own needs, and they make sure that they take care of someone else's family while that's happening. An example is Christina Stalier, who makes $11 an hour after working in healthcare for over 20 years. She's currently a home care worker. She says a raise would allow her to spend more time with her three children, maybe quit one of her other jobs, and pay for the medical bills her special needs child that are currently not covered. Christina's story is similar to many other caregivers, people who work multiple jobs so that they can afford to be a caregiver. Jennifer Maynard, for example, drives a cab for 36 to 40 hours a week in addition to being a caregiver, just so she can afford the basics. But she doesn't want to stop caregiving because she loves it and her clients rely on her. The need for jobs in caregiving is growing fast. In the next 10 years, as some of us know, there will be 230,000 more Oregonians who are over the age of 75. If we don't make sure that caregiver jobs are quality jobs, we will not have the workforce we need to care for our families. Now, on to Bill 1532A. It is estimated...
And if you could wrap it up.
Sure, absolutely. This bill will impact over 600,000 workers, it's estimated, like the women I've talked about in this economy. Additionally, this bill gives many of the workers under it a 50-cent raise this year in a year that they didn't receive a raise, putting an additional $1,050 in the pockets of Oregon's lowest-wage workers in the coming year. Some facts about who those workers are. I think many of us have heard about those, so I'll skip that. Real quick, I did want to mention that Senate Bill 1532A is not the bill that we would have written. We would have much rather passed policy that phased in quicker and lifted preemption, like the ballot measures we've worked on. We believe that the third tier leaves many workers behind. This is a really important component that I want to make sure gets on the record. Three of the counties in the third tier have the highest percentage of people of color in the state, once again creating policy that disproportionately impacts people of color. We're also concerned that the different regions don't reflect the cost of living. When you compare Bend and the cost of living in Bend, obviously it costs very similarly in Bend what it costs for a worker in the Portland metro area, yet Bend workers under this proposal will have a significantly lower wage raise. We believe that people who do work hard...
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And we appreciate the governor and the legislature's really significant attention to this issue. Thanks, Chair.
Questions? Representative Esquivel, did you have a question?
I had a question on the last panel.
Okay. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Graham, you sparked a question. I actually had a different one. But the big concern I have is... one of the things that's happening in this legislative session, we're being faced with, oh, you got to do this, or it's a ballot measure. I know AFSCME, SEIU is very heavily invested in this. Are they going to get rid of the ballot measures if we pass this, or are we doing this for nothing because we're going to be overruled by a ballot measure if we do something here?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, that's a great question. I think it's too early to tell what's going to happen after session. We're a long way between now and the end of session. Obviously, the legislature is going to grapple with this. I can say for our organization, we'll have to have a board meeting after the legislative session ends and make a decision about how we proceed. I will say, though, that the ballot measures and this legislation and our engagement in that is truly about workers needing this this raise today, frankly, and it's driving the urgency in 2016 and brings us to where we're at today. So that's how I would answer that question.
Follow up. I just want, because he drove the point home that this is not enough. So, I mean, we could be spinning our wheels for nothing here.
Thanks for your being, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The premise here is a full-time worker should not live in poverty. And I had this analysis that came to me this morning, and it has to do with the structure of adult poverty in the U.S. So the working full-time person who is living in poverty, there's 3 million people there. The ones not working, 16 million. Working part-time, 8 million. People with disabilities, 4 million. Retired seniors, 4 million. So you have 32 million people here that will be affected by this before you get to the 3 million who are actually working. And so, you know, when these are staggering numbers here, and this is a U.S. Study here, but we take it down to Oregon, and it's going to probably be around the same, you know, as far as ratios. And so to affect 32 million people when you're trying to help 3 million just doesn't seem to make sense. And I have not seen an economic analysis from the other side that says this thing will work. All we have seen is economic analysis that says we will put more people out of work and we will create hardships in families. And so, you know, it's fine, and this is a tough issue, and there are a lot of people, I think, that we have heard over the last year and a half that are struggling, and I see that. But are we going to create a problem here where we magnify the problem even more than what we're trying to fix? And I have not seen a study yet that says this is going to work.
I'm not sure what the question was, but go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and Representative Barreto. There actually have been some studies done. The Oregon Center for Public Policy did a study on the last large minimum wage here in Oregon that showed a relatively small impact in terms of jobs. And part of that is because while you lose some in one industry, in others they grow because there's more money circulating in the economy. And furthermore, some people who are having to work two jobs now only have to work one, which frees up additional jobs. So I do believe there is good research on the other side, and I'd be happy to make that available to you.
I would love to get that. Thank you.
Send it right now.
Representative Nose.
I'm sorry, no, I did not have a question. It was a while ago.
No, thank you. Other questions?
Could I have my other one? Mr. Chair?
Another question. Well, I had one, but go ahead.
I was just kind of curious because you hit kind of on the theme, because your company's located here in Oregon, and which it works if we do a statewide increase to $15 an hour. But how's that affect all of our businesses that and farms that sell outside the state? Because you can't take all of the blueberries from a plant or all the strawberries or kiwis or whatever they're growing, and they have to sell into other states, and the price is pretty much set to where they get X margin. So if we put this mandate, do you not see a lot of jobs leaving the state of Oregon?
Thank you, Representative Wainwright, for your question, and Chair Holvey. Certainly, we've heard concerns from our agricultural partners across the state. It's a real issue around commodity agricultural products and the differences state to state. And at New Seasons Market, we don't necessarily have all the answers. I can tell you that the way we do business is to partner with local vendors within our community and to understand their business practices, and we believe in paying a premium to them for what they do, whether it's taking care of the planet, taking care of their people, how they operate their businesses. You know, many of our suppliers operate in rural parts of the state, and part of the reason why we feel so strongly about Senate Bill 1532 is that we believe that any minimum wage policy should take into account regional cost of living differences, and this bill does that. This is also why we think this kind of complexity is why we think that having a legislative approach to a resolution is the right way versus a ballot measure, which will be very broad brush and won't be able to necessarily take care of the particularities that this kind of legislation could do. Thank you.
Other questions? Just to follow up on that, I had heard you say some things that, you know, because I have seen, you know, studies from all over the map, and some of those studies did show that businesses were able usually pass these costs on to their consumers. Obviously, the agriculture industry does have some commodity constraints. Mm-hmm. But the issue of being able to absorb these and pass them on to the consumer, mm-hmm. how do you deal with what people are talking about compression? Do you see mm-hmm. that the minimum wage is going to require you to raise the wage for your highest employees?
Well, thank you for your question, Chair Holvey. We actually believe that raising the minimum wage can and should result in change at more than just the very bottom level. In fact, at New Seasons, when we decided to change our starting wage to 12, we actually adjusted all of our wage scales, the top and the bottom of all. We felt that that was the right thing to do based on where the current cost of living is in our marketplace. And we, you know, as I said earlier in my testimony, we had realized that our wages were not keeping up with cost of living. So in order for people to be able to earn wages that enable them to support themselves and their family, we felt that all of the wages need to adjust. I think that is a reality, and I think that's also why we need a phased-in approach, as we see in this particular Senate bill, so that businesses like New Seasons and others can take the time to plan out over the course of this six-year phase-in how we're going to address the compression and those initial starting wages.
So, and to follow up on that, that is a business choice that you make. I did read some statistics where the compression seems to be largely between the median wage and the lower income, and not necessarily near as impactful at the upper wages. But that's a business choice, I would assume, that any particular business would make as to how much compression they're willing to adjust all their wages.
Sure. Yes.
Thank you. Well, I have, Representative Hurd, I'll give you one 20-second question because that's about all we have.
All right, Miss, I'm speaking to you. I was listening closely, and thank you for coming today. I was listening closely to your life story about what happened to you and your family, and I'm sorry for the struggles you guys had to go through. One of the key things that you said that spoke to me and is related to my question is that it happened in Salem. You were living here in Salem. Your cost of living in Salem was low. You spoke about that, and that was one of the aspects that made it possible for you to make ends meet at a lower wage. The lady to your left just said, and I'm a small business owner, so I will confirm what she just said, that yes, the people I'm paying $17.50 an hour right now to be my top-level manager of a job site, I'm going to have to pay them $20 an hour, or whatever it is. As it goes up at the bottom, my bottom-tier folks that don't have half the responsibilities, I will have to elevate the pay throughout my payroll. Thus, my prices must go up because there's a margin I must keep to stay in business. Would you acknowledge or would you disagree that there will be inflation effects on food, daycare, all those cost of livings that you spoke of were so cheap here, that's going to be an issue, and that, in my opinion, and I want yours on it, doesn't that possibly put us in a position where this increase is washed out and neutral?
So Chair Holvey and Representative Hurd, items go up every year, so there is a cost of living every year, and even now, with the minimum wage, there is a cost of living increase with that. So over time, yes, all things will rise. However, I believe that the increase in this minimum wage will help so many people afford the basics. The percent increase in the minimum wage will not affect businesses to the extent that they will have to rise at the same level. So, you know, spreading out your costs among employees, there will be some price increases, but I believe the economic studies show that the increase in the minimum wage far outweighs the increase in prices that will occur.
Mr. Chair, I beg you a 10-second follow-up.
Thank you very much. I really do have to adjourn because requirements from the caucuses to meet before floor. So I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing of Senate Bill 1532. And we will recess the House Business and Labor Committee till 5:30. Thank you. Committee till 5:30. Thank you.